Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, Hit Parade listeners. What you're about to hear is part one of this episode. Part two will arrive in your podcast feed at the end of the month. Would you like to hear this episode all at once, the day it drops? Sign up for Slate Plus. You can try it for a month for just $1, and it supports not only this show, but all of Slate's acclaimed journalism and podcasts. Just go to slate.com/hitparadeplus. You'll get to hear every Hit Parade episode in full the day it arrives, plus Hit Parade The Bridge, our bonus episodes, with guest interviews, deeper dives on our episode topics, and pop chart trivia. Once again, to join, that's slate.com/hitparadeplus. Thanks. And now, please enjoy part one of this Hit Parade episode.
This episode contains explicit language.
Welcome to Hit Parade, a podcast of pop chart history from Slate Magazine, about the hits from coast to coast. I'm Chris Malanfi, chart analyst, pop critic, and writer of Slate's Why Is This Song Number One series. On today's show, 31 years ago, in June of 1990, the clown prince of hip-hop, Biz Markie, was spending his 22nd and final week on the Hot 100 with his one and only pop hit, Just a Friend, a song in which Biz serves as his own featured act, delivering both the rapped verse and a sung chorus, one that millions of people are still drunkenly singing along with to this day.
But you say he's just a friend.
So I took blah blah's word for it at this time. I thought just having a friend couldn't be no crime. Cause I have friends, and that's a fact, like Agnes, Agatha, Jermaine, and Jack.
Just a Friend was a number 9 pop, number 37 R&B single, the only Hot 100 hit or major R&B hit of any kind for the Biz, making him a one-hit wonder. But 12 years after Biz Markie's one hit, teen singer Mario Barrett, who went by the mononym Mario, brought Just a Friend back to both charts.
I wanna know you in and out. I wanna know what you're all about.
I wanna know.
Except in Mario's version, titled Just a Friend 2002, he was singing everything. A completely different verse with an all new tale of unrequited love, and a chorus nearly identical to Biz Markie's, but far less comical.
Yeah. But you say I'm just a friend.
This prompts some questions. Was Just a Friend always a straight-up R&B song in rap song clothing? Was it waiting for a pure R&B singer to wrap his vocals around it? Was it called rap in 1990 because the funniest parts of it are rapped, or simply because Biz Markie is a rapper? What about the fact that Biz sang the chorus, albeit not as mellifluously as Mario later would? Questions like these were novelties in 1990. By 2002, they were less novel. And two decades later, we are no longer surprised when so-called rappers are scoring hits by mostly singing.
Brand new Lamborghini, a cop car, with a pistol on my hip like I'm a cop. Have you ever met a real rock star? This ain't no guitar, this a clock.
How did we get here? When did the wall fall between dropping bars and carrying a tune? most of the first wave of rappers in the 80s wouldn't be caught dead singing.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Along the way, hip-hop production styles found their way into pure R&B, even when the R&B artists were still singing. And eventually, rappers were slipping melody into their bars, sometimes singing unassisted. Sometimes making digital era singing tools part of their rap. By the 2010s, a new generation of rappers had so blurred the lines between R&B and hip-hop that songs containing no actual rapping were labeled rap.
And I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing.
Drake is perhaps the most prominent artist erasing the lines between singing and rapping in the 21st century. But if there is a locus of power between singing and rapping, it's the first couple of Rap and B, aka J and B. Since Jay-Z and Beyoncé joined forces, both professionally and as a couple, in the early aughts, Mr. Sean Carter and Ms. Beyoncé Knowles Carter have crossed into each other's territory. Jay almost entirely avoids singing, but he has, on very rare occasion, sung a bit here and there. And Queen Bee, she has taken to dropping bars with a flow distinct from her husband's and all her own.
My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana, you mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama.
But arguably, Beyoncé's greater innovation in the field of singing and rapping came before she and Jay ever met. When she was still a teenager in Destiny's Child, the young Ms. Knowles was already vocalizing with the flow of a rapper. And in so doing, she helped change the game.
The other day, I would call, you would say, baby, how's your day? But today, it ain't the same.
And that's where your hit parade marches today, the week ending March 18th, 2000, when Say My Name by Destiny's Child reached number one on both the Hot 100 and the chart Billboard now called Hot R&B / Hip Hop Singles. The hip hop had been added just 1 year before, acknowledging what rising groups like Beyoncé's had already made obvious. R&B vocals and hip hop flow were fusing. Say My Name is a pivot point, but there are many examples, both before and after Queen Bee decided to sing like she was spitting fire. When and how did singing and rapping merge into one chart-topping genre? Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply. In 2017, Toronto-based rapper and singer Aubrey Graham, aka Drake, gave an interview to Apple Music the day after he won 2 Grammy Awards. But Drake, who hadn't bothered to show up at the Grammys the night before and collect his prizes, he wasn't really feeling them.
Last night at that award show, I am apparently a rapper, you know, even though Hotline Bling is not a rap song. The only category that they can manage to fit me in is in a rap category. Maybe because I've rapped in the past or because I'm black. I can't figure out why. I love the rap world and I love the rap community, but you're right. I write pop songs for a reason. I won two awards last night, but I don't even want them because it just feels weird putting me in that category because it's the only place you can figure out where to put me. When you ask me, like, do I feel racism? You don't really notice it like that until I start talking about the music business.
There's something a bit ironic about Drake, of all people, complaining about the Recording Academy calling his sung song a rap song. I mean, fundamentally, he is right. Hotline Bling, Drake's Grammy winner for both Best Rap Song and Best Rap/Sung Performance, has no actual rapping in it.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone.
But New York Times critic John Caramonica went so far as to credit Drake with inventing, or at least popularizing, a new form. In his 2019 article, quote, "Rappers Are Singers Now, Thank Drake," Caramonica wrote that Mr. Aubrey Graham, quote, "fundamentally rewrote the rules of what it meant to be a rapper in the 2010s, singing as rapping, rapping as singing, singing and rapping all woven together into one holistic whole. In Drake's hands, rapping and singing were in constant, graceful dialogue.
I want this forever, I swear I could spend whatever on it. Could she hold me down every time I hit up?
Caramonica wrote this at the twilight of the 10s. In the early 20s, this so-called post-Drake era certainly hasn't ended. Your Hit Parade host, who is also Slate's Why Is This Song Number One columnist, continues to write about chart-topping quote-unquote rap songs in which nobody is talking in cadence over a beat. Hip-hop superstars like, say, Polo G pretty much sing all the way through, such as on his 2021 number one hit Rap Star, which Polo croons over, no kidding, a ukulele.
I ain't joking, do it sound like I'm kidding. I've been making like 2,000 a minute. So high up through the clouds, I was swimming.
While I do agree with John Caramonica that Drake helped change the game, turning sing-rapping into the primary mode for hip-hop, I also recall that way back when Aubrey Graham was still playing Jimmy on the Canadian teen TV soap Degrassi: The Next Generation, rappers were already employing melodic cadence, basically singing on their hits, whether they could sing or not.
To everybody that be living it up, we say,
what I do.
And all my ladies that be giving it up.
And well before the 21st century, rapping and singing were being hybridized. As we noted in last month's Hit Parade, Frank Farian's late 80s Europop confection Milli Vanilli fused tunes and bars from the jump way back in 1989, including on the hit they stole from a Baltimore hip-hop crew. But the story of sing rapping goes back even further than that. For decades, we've heard closed-minded complaints that rap, quote, isn't music or has nothing to do with singing. But regardless of what these disdainers say, from that grumpy rock-loving uncle you see at Thanksgiving to famous grumpy uncles like David Crosby or Gene Simmons, the fact is, from its very origins, rap records have carried a tune.
Regenerated, less complicated, vibrating, educating, stimulating, young and old as a whole, those and old jazz is prose.
This track is called Jazzoetry, an appropriate title given the worlds of jazz and poetry being smashed together by the artistic collective known as The Last Poets. Critics have long credited this sprawling group of artist-coup musicians with prefiguring hip-hop more than a half century ago, with their bespoke blend of spoken word lyrics and groovy rhythms. They weren't exactly rapping, but their patter was clearly musical. The roots of rap, in other words, had the cadence of song.
While your horn is blowing, putting on the show, digging some more Black Eagle.
Jazzoetry is vocalized by Last Poets co-founder Jalal Nuruddin. But you're probably more familiar with another Last Poet, who broke away and did his own thing, Gil Scott-Heron.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle.
Scott-Heron produced both spoken word tracks, like the legendary The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, and songs that were sung, such as this heartbreaker Kanye West would sample decades later.
I left 3 days ago, but no one seems to know I'm gone.
But while Gil Scott-Heron's albums would feature his singing and his proto-rapping side by side, he generally did not combine them. It was only when musicians better known for their singing began experimenting with a more recognizable rap style that the genre began to take shape on record. For example, on his one-off single Rap-O Clap-O in 1979, Latin boogaloo and salsa vocalist Joe Batán came up with a clap-your-hands invocation that became a timeless rap trope.
Got a new beat and I want you to know it's a new thing I call Mesty Soul. Just clap your hands, everybody, everybody, clap your hands.
For artists like Batán or funk group The Fatback Band, whose King Tim III personality jock we played you in our Def Jams episode of Hit Parade 3 years ago, these early rap experiments were just extensions of the call and response music they'd been making for years.
You just clap your hands and you stomp your feet because you're listening to the sound of the show shot beat. I'm the K-I-N-G, the T-I-M, King Tim III, and I am him.
The major difference between these two 1979 tracks and the single that's now known the world over as rap's official first recorded hit, Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, is that the Sugar Hill Gang actually, self-consciously, tell you they're rapping. Of course, Rapper's Delight has plenty of actual music supporting the rapping. As we've covered several times on Hit Parade, the team at Sugar Hill Records stole from the best, the bass line from Chic's 1979 number one hit, Good Times.
Good Times!
But the Sugar Hill team wanted you to notice the rap as distinct from the music. In essence, the debate over whether rappers should be melodic was baked right into the genre's first hit. During rap's early years, some of the boldest sing and rap experimentation came from artists not endemic to hip-hop, who were, nonetheless, deeply influential. This includes, most famously, Blondie, who came up through legendary New York punk club CBGB and whose Hot 100 number one, Rapture, finds Debbie Harry both singing and rapping. Or funk godfather and Parliament Funkadelic leader George Clinton, whose 1983 number one R&B hit Atomic Dog evoked the hip-hop ethos. An electro-funk classic, Atomic Dog evoked rap, even though Clinton wasn't exactly rapping. He was either singing or talking his way through.
Bow, wow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yay.
Untapped dog!
perhaps most influential in this period of rap pop or rap funk hybrids was this classic, a side gig by another gang of former CBGB punks. Tom Tom Club was a side project of Talking Heads rhythm section Chris France and Tina Weymouth. In 1981, the married drummer and bassist released Genius of Love, an ingenious hybrid of new wave, hip-hop breakbeats, and even dub reggae, courtesy of Jamaican producer and co-songwriter Stephen Stanley. Remarkably, despite France and Weymouth's rock roots, Genius of Love was a bigger hit on the R&B chart, where it hit number 2, then on the Hot 100, where it reached number 31. Even more remarkably, Genius of Love proved one of the most influential singles in hip-hop history, sampled dozens of times. The duo Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde covered it almost immediately in 1981, converting Tina Weymouth's singing into straight-up rapping on Genius Rap. I'm full of fire, full of fun. But by the late 80s, the melody of Genius of Love was creeping back in. In 1988, West Coast MC Mixmaster Spade sing-rapped his lines while throwing a diss at Jekyll and Hyde. Party people, I'm so glad you're here. I want the girl that's in the front, my homies in the rear. I'm not Dr. Jekyll nor Mr. Hyde. Whoever told you that, they told you a lie. Of course, the best known cover of Genius of Love, flashing ahead to the mid-90s, was entirely sung. Mariah Carey's Fantasy, a 1995 reboot of the Tom Tom Club's hit. Carey was clearly looking to invoke the song's hip-hop roots as much as its pop hooks, from the old Dirty Bastard verse on the remix to the song's thick breakbeats. Fantasy arguably echoes Mixmaster Spade as much as it does Tom Tom Club. And if you pass our class, young boys and girls, we'll welcome you into a rapping world. Other 80s rappers who sang included Brooklyn trio Houdini, who both rapped their verses and sang their choruses on hits like Friends and Freaks Come Out at Night. Now the party's jumping, the place is packed, and when the crowd's like this, I'm ready to rap. And on a storied, two-sided 1985 hit single from Doug E. Fresh and the Get Fresh Crew, British-born rapper Slick Rick slipped in some very famous melodies on both sides. On The Show, the single's A-side, Slick Rick dropped in a few bars of The Beatles. Golly, she was raised in hell. She said, oh, my name is Maggie, but call me Michelle. And on the flip side, La Di Da Di, which got almost as much black radio airplay as The Show, Slick Rick crooned the melody and lyrics from A Taste of Honey's 1981 hit, Sukiyaki. So I said, what's wrong? Because she looked upset. She said, it's all because of you. I'm feeling sad and blue. You went away, and now my life is filled with rainy days. This infusion of melody into hip-hop hits was, in some ways, a ploy to get rap on the radio. Station programmers needed to be convinced that rap wasn't a fad, including R&B radio program directors, who were in some ways even more skeptical about rap than their counterparts at Top 40 radio. As we noted in our Def Jams episode, overcoming this bias was more or less what LL Cool J had in mind in 1987 when he recorded I Need Love. On the seminal rap ballad, LL came as close to singing without actually singing, as a rapper with street cred reasonably could.
One half of me deserves to be this way till I'm old, but the other half needs affection and joy, and the warmth that is created by a girl and a boy. I need love.
And speaking of street cred, while radio did embrace I Need Love, it ultimately reached number 14 on the Hot 100 and number 1 on the R&B chart, the single hurt LL Cool J with his fellow rappers. Even though he hadn't actually sung on the track, its appeal to women painted a target for other rappers to take potshots at. Indirectly, it may even have contributed to LL's nearly decade-long beef with Kool Moe Dee, a leader of the school of so-called lyrical rap that emphasized bars over melody.
Sucker MCs in the place that said I could only rock rhymes and only rock crowds, but never rock records. How you like me now?
This brings up a sociocultural subtext underlying the question of melody in rap, the need for rappers to maintain hardness, and hence a certain machismo. Other rappers who emphasized so-called lyricism over anything that read as pop or R&B crossover included Boogie Down Productions leader Chris Parker, aka KRS-One.
The bridge is over, the bridge is over. You see me coming in the dance with the flipper sensia, down with the sound called BDP.
As you may recall from our Hit Parade episode about early 90s hip-hop, KRS-One got into his own beef with the melodic rap troupe PM Dawn, who routinely sang on their hits. The music press at the time portrayed KRS-One's bum-rushing of PM Dawn's Prince B at a live concert as not only his defense of rap purism, it was also evidence, even though Prince B had affirmed that he was straight, of hardcore rap's vilification of anything seen as gay, fey, or female. Even in its more peaceable moments, lyricism in hip-hop meant rappers not only dropped killer rhymes, but maintained a wall between rap and musical cadence. When the rap duo Eric B. and Rakim titled their 1986 B-side classic My Melody, that witty title was meant ironically. Rakim raps Check Out My Melody over an unsparing beat with scarcely any melody at all.
My name is Rakim Allah, and R-A stand for raw, switch it around. It still comes out all so easily. Will I E-M-C-E-E? My repetition of words, just check out my melody.
What all of this purism ultimately meant was that, during hip-hop's first decade, male rappers largely avoided the melodic rap lane, leaving it wide open for women to give it a try.
We always hanging up a below stance. We do the dive every time we dance. I give you love, baby, not romance. I make a move, nothing left to chance.
Nana Cherry's Buffalo Stance, a number 3 pop hit in 1989, blended elements of club, electro, and freestyle, as the Swedish-born Cherry both rapped and sang in both American and British accents.
When it comes to deep punch, looking good.
It was a groundbreaking single that showed how global rap had become, and that it could embrace melody while still sounding street. Buffalo Stance even reached number 16 on Billboard's Rap Songs chart, a strong showing for a woman rapper in 1989. And what about this multi-hyphenate?
Break into a lyrical freestyle, grab the mic, look at the crowd and see smiles, cause they see a woman standing up on her own two.
Queen Latifah was the highest profile solo woman MC of rap's golden age. From very early on her hits like 1989's Ladies First, Latifah was eager to show she could do it all, rapping with the speed and lyricism of her male peers, but also willing to deploy melodic hooks, Latifah would sometimes even handle the melodies by herself, as on her 1993 hit UNITY. By the early 90s, rappers with melodic sensibilities, like Latifah, were no longer alone. Women who were singers were claiming space in hip-hop, and one woman defined the category.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Mary Jane Blige, born in the Bronx, raised in both Savannah, Georgia and Yonkers, New York, was the prototypical artist of what came to be known as hip-hop soul. A gifted and gritty singer, Mary J. Blige grew up with rap, and so it didn't feel incongruous to her to sing over rap beats. So I had to sing it, 'cause for you, boy. That included beats served up for her by young producer Sean Puff Daddy Combs. Puffy produced bangers for Blige, like her debut single, the R&B chart topper, You Remind Me. Ever the hype man, Sean Combs was already billing Blige as Queen of Hip Hop Soul from the jump, the moment her 1992 debut album, What's the 411, dropped. Mind you, Blige could actually rap if she wanted to, as she proved early on in a collaboration with Brand Nubian rapper Grand Poobah.
Yeah, now what makes you different than the next in your last week and you couldn't even speak? You try to play like Mr. All of That, but now you want to come to me with some chit-chat?
But Blige didn't become the queen of hip-hop soul by simply rapping. The more vital part of her legacy was how she infused gospel-style R&B singing with rap bravado. She didn't just hold her own alongside rappers like Grand Poobah or LL Cool J. Instead, Blige was defining a new model of hip-hop cadence with both melody and flow. Blige became so well-established in the rap world, she even helped introduce another young rapper mogul named Sean a couple of years later.
I got the Godfather flow, the Don Juan DeMarco. Swear to God, don't get it fucked up.
But we'll come back to Sean Carter in a bit. By the 90s, rap had also matured into other forms that would branch off from the lyricist family tree.
Shoo, yabba, doo, hibbity, hoo, cracker, bruce, a trick or treat. From my feet, yep, I dribbity, drop the hit. The books get on your walk and spark that old shit.
Brooklyn rap duo Das FX sported a unique rapid-fire rhyming style with tongue-tripping wordplay. Their debut album, Dead Serious, went platinum on the strength of hits like their number 25 pop, number 5 R&B hit, They Want Effects.
They want effects.
While Das FX didn't actually sing, their rippity-rapping approach had a melodic flow. And even though the duo's hit-making days were relatively short-lived, they did influence another crew from Cleveland, Ohio, with a much longer hit-making career. This quintet, who called themselves Bone Thugs in Harmony, took Das FX's speedy style and added actual melody.
Waking up, feeling buzz up early in the morning, stretching, I'm yawning, lightweight bitch, chug a lug, I take a fist to the dawn, it's mad, I got geek with my truck, but it dance, so I'm getting me hustle long.
Bone Thugs in Harmony are arguably the patient zero of the sing and rap infection. Back in the 90s, the most unforgiving hip-hop purists did not even consider Bone Thugs rappers. But fans and the music industry considered their syncopated bounce a form of rap, as did all five Bone Thugs themselves: Busy Bone, Wishbone, Lazy Bone, Crazy Bone, and Flesh and Bone. MTV would later call Bone Thugs in Harmony the most melodic hip-hop group of all time, and their sing-songy approach was deeply influential on what now qualifies as rap. On hits like First of the Month, Bone Thugs paired head-spinning rhymes with sweet R&B-style harmonies. Those melodies got even sweeter on their 1996 smash, The Crossroads, an homage to their late mentor, Eazy-E of N.W.A. If there was any doubt about the appeal of Bone Thugs' style, The Crossroads, which spent 7 weeks at number one on the R&B chart and 8 weeks on top of the Hot 100, made those quibbles moot. The album that spawned these hits, E1999 Eternal, went quadruple platinum. By the late 90s, Bone Thugs were even appearing on the soundtrack to a Batman movie.
Look into my eyes and tell me what it is you see in my eyes.
And by the early aughts, they were rapping alongside, no kidding, Phil Collins. Seriously, he's right there in the video with them. Google it if you don't believe me.
Lord, I feel like I'm losing it right now, right now, now.
Some argued at the time that Bone Thugs were not so much rapping, or exactly singing, as toasting. That's the chanting style of singing Jamaican DJs, adapted from African griots, and made essential in reggae and dancehall music. The form was perfected by such 60s and 70s Jamaican vocalists as U-Roy.
Now we the diamonds of the people. I've got a musical diesel, I kill it for jubilee. Like a clean musical disc, we're straight.
By the 90s, however, dancehall had been modernized for the hip-hop era and was rising alongside rap as a commercial proposition. Reggae fusion artists like Shabba Ranks.
Mr. Loverman,
Shabba,
I can't
wait. Where's it for us? You're on the internet, come.
Were appearing on soundtracks like 1992's Deep Cover, the album that launched the rapping careers of Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg. Dancehall was now side by side with gangsta rap.
Witness the hit because I'm going deep cover. Yeah, and yeah, don't stop.
Cause it's 187 on an undercover car.
Shabba Ranks even teamed directly with rappers, as on his 1992 hit, The Jam, with KRS-One. By the mid-90s, dancehall and reggae fusion artists were breaking at pop radio, most prominently Jamaican-American vocalist Shaggy. His singles, like his 1995 number 3 smash Boombastic, crossed reggae toasting with American hip-hop and pure pop.
Well, I'm boombastic, really fantastic, put me in my box, it says I'm Mr. Rowe.
This success by reggae and dancehall had a knock-on effect on homegrown American rappers, which led to the next great multi-platinum milestone in sing and rap fusion.
A boy on the side of Babylon trying to front like you're down with Mount Zion.
New Jersey trio The Fugees, Praz Michel, Wyclef Jean, and Ms. Lauryn Hill lasted only 5 active years and just 2 albums. Their first, Blunted on Reality, didn't even chart. But that second album, their chart-dominating 1996 blockbuster The Score, secured The Fugees' legacy. The trio produced a seamless blend of rap, R&B, and even reggae that sounded remarkably natural and helped to permanently blur the lines of melody and lyricism in hip-hop. Their breakthrough single, Fuji La, sounded like it could have emanated from either Trenchtown in Kingston or South Orange, New Jersey, where the Fugees actually formed. And alongside the rhymes by Wyclef and Praz, Lauryn Hill switched smoothly from rapping to singing. Of course, this number 29 pop, number 13 R&B hit wasn't the big hit that led The Score to shift 7 million copies in America alone and 22 million worldwide. Mostly, the album blew up because of this.
Strumming my pain with his finger.
One time.
Singing my life with his words.
The Fugees' cover of Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly, a showcase for Lauryn Hill's husky contralto voice that topped Billboard's radio charts in both R&B and mainstream pop, and made Hill a star. The thing is, good as she was at singing, it was far from Hill's only skill. In addition to her acting credibly in a handful of films and her songwriting, Lauryn Hill was a serious rapper with wicked flow.
So why you imitating Al Capone? I be needing Simone and defecating on your microphone.
So while both Wyclef and, to a lesser extent, Praz went on to lucrative careers of their own, it was their Fuji sister who transitioned most successfully to solo work on 1998's now legendary The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Hill's critically acclaimed, Grammy-winning, multi-platinum album had a truly wide-ranging definition of hip-hop. Hill dropped bars, as she had on The Score, but then pivoted to singing her own choruses, as on her Hot 100 number one smash, Doo Wop That Thing.
Girls, you know you better watch out. Some guys are only about.
By the time Miseducation came out, Lauryn was not alone. Hip-hop had widened its lens and fused with much of the music on the charts. Innovative producer Timbaland was working with both rapper Missy Elliott and, on the cutting-edge smash Are You That Somebody, R&B singer Aaliyah. The aforementioned Sean Carter, a.k.a. Jigga, a.k.a. Hova, a.k.a. Jay-Z, scored his first number one album, Hard Knock Life, led off by a single in which he rapped over a hook from a Broadway show.
From standing on the corners bopping to driving some of the hottest cars New York has ever seen, for dropping some of the hottest verses rappers ever heard.
Notwithstanding his wide-ranging taste in samples, Jay emerged as one of the last of his generation of straight-up rappers, focused on consummate technique. The man who would later dub himself Rap's Frank Sinatra was, in essence, a classicist, and, in rap terms, a lyricist, a deliverer of bars. And what about Jay's future wife? she was still in the process of making her date with Destiny, ironically with a member of the Fugees. The creation of Destiny's Child is an oft-told tale, including some storytelling and myth-making by Beyoncé herself on her albums decades later. As AllMusic's Hollywood Steve Huey notes, quote, "For a time, Destiny's Child were known for their drama as much as their music," unquote. We needn't get into all that drama in our charts-based story here. Suffice it to say that, of course, the key member of Destiny's Child, if you will, the predestined child, was Beyoncé Giselle Knowles, born in Houston in 1981. By 1997, Destiny's Child was a foursome of singers: Kelly Rowland, Latavia Roberson, LaToya Luckett, and, of course, the 16-year-old Beyoncé, whose father, Matthew Knowles, managed the group. They had already appeared on that year's Men in Black soundtrack and recorded a self-titled debut album, and they were about to score their first hit, thanks largely to Wyclef Jean.
"I don't care about your size, girl, shake your thighs, all I'm trying to do in the hood is stay alive."
The irresistible No No No, officially titled No 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 Part 2, because this version had been remixed just to include Wyclef, it was easy to assume that Clef, who both produced and rapped on the record, was the prime mover, the reason it was a hit in that peak Fugees moment. But that sells short the uniqueness of Destiny's Child's sound. They had church-raised soul voices, but they delivered their vocals with the syncopation of rappers. No 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 Part 2 peaked at number 3 on the Hot 100 and number 1 on the R&B chart in March of 1998. But Destiny's Child's follow-up singles for the rest of that year barely cracked the R&B chart and missed the pop chart entirely. By the end of 98, it was pretty safe to assume Destiny's Child could be a one-hit wonder. Imagine, if you can, a time when we thought we might never again hear from Beyoncé Knowles. What Destiny's Child had in common with the Fugees, not just Wyclef Jean, but most especially Lauryn Hill, was helping to redefine the breadth of commercial R&B in the hip-hop era. But here was the difference. Hill, for all her soul and impeccable technique, largely rapped like a rapper and sang like a singer. On her much-sampled follow-up hit, The Aching X Factor, Hill unfurled her gorgeous singing voice with grit and soul, but she wasn't pretending it was a rap track.
"No matter how big we grow, you always seem to let me know it ain't working, it ain't working, it ain't working."
And while Hill added some hip-hop elements to her cover songs, like her remake of Frankie Valli's 1967 hit Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, in which she dropped a 1-2, a 1-2 mic check, she essentially delivered these songs' melodies straight, beautifully, but not like rap.
"You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you."
No wonder The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill won the 1999 Grammy for Album of the Year, the first hip-hop album to achieve this feat, and one of the last. It was a rap album legible to music business elders, one that, half the time, you could forget was ever rapped. Mind you, had Hill continued her career as a recording artist, given her influence and her prodigious talent, she might well have further redefined the shape of rap, not just for herself, but for all of hip-hop. Infamously, however, Miseducation remains, still, 23 years later, Lauryn Hill's only solo studio LP, after a poorly received and erratically delivered MTV Unplugged album in 2002 containing some half-finished songs.
"I hope you can hear me.
'cause I know it's not profound.
Lauryn Hill, queen of hip-hop, quietly retired from recording, leaving Miss Education as her essentially perfect artistic statement, which meant that it would fall to others to turn rapping into singing, or perhaps more unexpectedly, turn singing into rapping. When we come back, destiny is fulfilled as Queen Bee assumes her throne, teams up with rap's Frank Sinatra, and watches as the center of hip-hop, from Ye to Drizzy, shifts in her direction.
Taking me places I ain't never been.
Non-Slate Plus listeners will hear the rest of this episode in 2 weeks. For now, I hope you've been enjoying this episode of Hit Parade. Our show was written, edited, and narrated by Chris Malanfi. That's me. My producer is Asha Saluja, and we also had help from Rosemary Belson. Special thanks also this month to Oliver Wong, who provided invaluable hip-hop history lessons. June Thomas is the senior managing producer and Gabriel Roth, the editorial director of Slate Podcasts. Check out their roster of shows at slate.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to Hit Parade wherever you get your podcasts, in addition to finding it in the Slate Culture feed. If you're subscribing on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us while you're there. It helps other listeners find the show. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to leading the Hit Parade back your way. We'll see you for part 2 in a couple of weeks. Until then, keep on marching on the one. I'm Chris Malanfi.
Now you've been maxing on my car. Pay me back credit, buy me gifts.